So we're going to talk about the foundations of quantum mechanics today. And so one of the deepest and most mysterious results that people studying the foundations of quantum mechanics are interested in is a result from the 60s by an Irish physicist by the name of John Bell. It's called Bell's theorem. And so basically this entire lecture is going to be about Bell's theorem and what's surprising about it, what's mysterious about quantum theory. And at the very end, I'm going to say a little bit about some of the applications of those foundational mysteries, and maybe something about what it means for quantizing gravity. So the approach that I'm going to take is to focus on causal explanation. So in recent years, so the last 15, 20 years, non-physicists, so people studying statistics, machine learning, classical problems, have generated a lot of new tools for how to infer causal relations from observed statistical correlations. So you sort of sometimes hear about how correlation does not imply causation. You have to be careful interpreting correlations. Well, we have a lot of new tools about converting from facts about correlations to facts about causation. And so I'm going to try to frame this problem of Bell's theorem in the context of that work. So I'm going to start out by telling you about correlation and causation and how to understand causation in a classical world among classical variables. And do feel free to stop me at any point to ask for explanations. So what's the difference between correlation and causation? So here's an example of a strong correlation, the sun rising and the rooster crowing. And correlation is a symmetric concept. And it's really about information. So it's really about saying there are two variables such that if I learn about one, I can update my knowledge about the other. So in this case, for example, if I'm in the farmhouse and the drapes are closed and I hear the rooster crow, I can immediately infer that the sun is rising. And similarly, if I read in my almanac that next month the sun will rise at 6 a.m., then I can infer that the rooster will crow at 6 a.m. So that's the symmetry. I can make inferences in either direction if I'm told that there's a strong correlation between two variables. So a causal relation is different. It's an asymmetric relationship, and it's about controlling one variable and thereby coming to control another variable. So here, if I ask, what happens if I make the rooster crow in the middle of the night by, squeezing it or doing, whatever it is you do to make roosters crow, does that cause the sun to rise? The answer is no, it doesn't. But if I make the sun rise early for the rooster, and I can do that by just moving the rooster eastward on the earth, and then for the rooster, the sun does rise earlier than it would have otherwise, then I find that the rooster does crow early as a result of that. So I can conclude that it's the sun rising that causes the rooster to crow and not the other way around. So that's very different from just the mere existence of this correlation. Right? So that's really what we're after, the difference between causation and correlation. And so it seems straightforward, but it turns out to be very subtle to try to disentangle these two concepts. So I want to show you how subtle it can be using a simple example from statistics, which is called Simpson's paradox. So the idea is this. You have a drug trial. So you've got some population of people who have some condition. And then you choose some subpopulation to administer a treatment, a drug. And then you just look at the number of people who recovered among those who got the drug. And among those who didn't get the drug, you look at the number who recovered, and you compare. And so suppose you find that the probability of recovery among those who got the drug is greater than the probability of recovery among those who didn't get the drug. Well, what would you say about this drug in that case? Looks like it might be effective, right? Because now you probably want to take this drug, given that data. But then, hang on. You look at the data more carefully, and you decide, I'm just going to look at the men in this drug trial. And if you look at the men who took the drug, and you ask how many of them recovered, and you look at the men who didn't take the drug, and you ask how many of them recovered, you find the inequality goes the other way. So the rate of recovery among the men who got the drug is less than the rate of recovery among the men who didn't get the drug. And now here's the real surprise. When you go and you look at the women, you also find that it goes the other way relative to the first one. So that's strange. And it seems like a paradox, because if you just want to read off what you're supposed to do from these kinds of inequalities, then it doesn't make any sense. You know, if it would seem to say that if you're a man or if you're a woman, you should not take the drug. But if you're a member of the general population, you should. So what do you do? So first of all, let me persuade you that this really can happen. You know, there are statistics that really exhibit this kind of behavior. So here's just a simple example of a drug trial that might do this. So here we have 300 men who get administered the drug, and we find that 180 of them recover. Turns out that's a 60% recovery rate. 100 men didn't get the drug, and 70 of them recovered, so that's a 70% recovery rate. So here among the men, this drug trial has a higher recovery rate for those who didn't get the drug. For the women, there were 100 who got the drug and 20 recovered, 300 who didn't get the drug and 90 recovered, and that works out to a 20% recovery rate over here, a 30% recovery rate over here. So again, the recovery rate is higher for those who didn't get the drug. But now I just have to take the totals to figure out the overall probability. So here there was 400 people in all who got administered the drug, and 200 of them recovered, so that's a 50% recovery rate. Over here, also 400 people were part of the set who didn't get the drug, and if I sum these guys up, I get 160, and that's smaller. It's a 40% recovery rate. So sure enough, in the averages, those who got the drug had a higher rate of recovery. So this should persuade you that, you know, this really can happen. You know, you could do a drug trial and find these outcomes. And now the question is, say this is, you know, you did this experiment, this is what you got. What should you do? Do you take the drug or not? What course of action do you follow? How do you make sense of this? And by make sense of it, I don't mean just show that there's no contradiction with probability theory. I mean, how do you make sense of it in terms of deciding what you ought to do based on what's happened in this drug trial? So, any ideas? Yes?
You say that it'd be better to take the drug because being a male or being a female shouldn't have a role or doesn't have a role in how the drug affects you, assuming that it doesn't have a role.
Well, but it would be dangerous to make that assumption, right? Because we know that it's conceivable that your gender could have an influence on, you know, how the drug interacts with your system. So it would be, yeah, I think you'd be unwise to make that assumption without some strong evidence that it's worth making. So from this alone, you don't get any evidence for that fact. So it's a bit dangerous to assume that. Yes? You'd look at this, yeah, and say, well, I'm going to do what this tells me. I'm going to not take the drug because over here. All right. Does anybody disagree with that? Or have something else to say? Yeah?
Couldn't you do, like, more mainstream, I guess, statistics in, like a one sample set test, for example, or, like, female and male or combined? So just like do like proper statistics instead of just looking at like percentages.
Suppose these things have fluctuations, right? So that but imagine that I did this over and over again. I made these numbers much, much bigger, and I got those fluctuations to be very small relative to the total size. So I became more and more confident that I really do have this reversal, that it's not just a consequence of some fluctuation. It's really robust. And that's, in fact, can happen. I can multiply all these numbers, you know, add a bunch of zeros, and everything would still go through. And so I don't think it's just a question of statistical fluctuations. This is something that's robust.
Yep.
Okay. It's still hard, though, to know whether you're you should sort of consider the null hypothesis, you know, for the men, for the women, or for the general population. So there's still a kind of, I don't think standard statistics is really going to tell you what question you should ask it to figure out what you ought to do. I mean, that's to some extent the problem. Yes? 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 You're right that you would not see this. If we had, you know, equal numbers here, you wouldn't be able to see this. So certainly, if you're doing a drug trial and you want to avoid these kinds of confusing situations, you should do it where you have equal numbers for men and women. But, you know, this was very expensive to do this drug trial. It's done. You've got to make a decision. What are you going to do? You can't, you know, redo the trial. It's been done. This is what happened. How do you analyze this data? That's the question. Yes?
Maybe what we could do is not take the drug, because if you look at the percentages and you see that drug, there would be 80 people on 200, and the other one would be 100 people on 200. So then the combined percentages just switch. So then you get, if you just look at the percentages, you get 50% chance of recovery with a no drug and 40%.
So I'm not sure what calculation you're doing. Where did this 80 on 200 come from?
If you just take the percentages and consider that for the male and the drug, mm-hmm. 60 people recovered on 100.
Six for the men,
with
the drug. 60 on 100. Yeah, this, yeah, okay.
Yes. And for the female, 20
yep.
on 100.
Yep.
Then you would get 80 people on 200 if you combine them.
Uh-huh.
So that would be 40% instead of 50%.
Okay, but I guess the question is, you know, why would you throw away the information about the fact that actually there were 300 men who took the drug and 180 recovered and replace that with this, you know, oh, let's imagine that it was 100 men and 60 of which recovered. It seems like that would be a sort of step in the wrong direction, sort of changing what actually happened and doing calculations based on that hypothesis. Unless you could provide some sort of reasoning for, you know, why those sorts of steps are the right way to analyze this data. Let me cut the discussion off at this point and just tell you about the how to resolve this. Let me first make one extra observation, which is just that there was an idea expressed that maybe as a man or a woman you should look at these and not this, on the grounds that, well, you know, that's more specific information. But a countervailing idea would be, well, you know, this number here involves more people in the drug trial, right? It combined the results of the men and the women together. So you might say, well, I could be more confident in the situation where we had everybody pooled together. So I think even those considerations, it's just not clear. So for me, if you just have statistics, you know, in your toolbox of how to think about things, you can't really get off the ground. You can't really answer this question. You need to start talking about what the causal explanation of this statistics might be. That's how the resolution comes. So let me show you the resolution. So first, why does it appear like a paradox? I think it's because we implicitly imagine that the causal structure looks something like this. So first of all, the treatment could obviously have a causal influence on recovery. You know, maybe the drug promotes recovery, maybe it's bad for recovery, but it has some causal influence. And we might also think, well, it's possible that, you know, men and women have differential rates of recovery regardless of whether or not they take the drug. It just might be that for this particular illness, you know, it's men recover more easily than women do, for example. And if you think this is what's going on, you cannot actually get this funny reversal. And the reason is, suppose that's what was going on, then if I wanted to calculate the probability of recovery given that somebody got the drug, all I would have to do is take the probability of recovery given that they got the drug and they were a man, times the probability of being a man, plus the probability of recovery given that they got the drug and they were a woman, times the probability they were a woman, sum those up, and I would get that number. And similarly, on the right-hand sides, to get this, I would just take the weighted sum of these two numbers with the probability of being a man and the probability of being a woman in this set, and in this particular set, you're equally likely to be a man or a woman. And the problem is that if I just take these two equations and I average the left-hand sides and I average the right-hand sides, I'm going to have the same direction of inequality. It's going to tell me that the overall average probability of recovery is less than the average probability of recovery if you didn't get the drug, the opposite of this. So if the causal structure is this one here, we can't possibly see those statistics. But we can see those statistics if the causal structure is this one. So here, we have gender having a causal influence on treatment. So the idea there is that if we've run the drug trial and the subjects were allowed to choose whether they got the drug or not, it could be that men were more likely to say, yes, I would like to try this drug treatment than women were. And in fact, if you look at these statistics, you'll see that here 300 men decided to take the drug and 100 didn't. And here 300 women decided not to take the drug and only 100 took the drug. So there was a difference in the number that got it. And you could explain that by a causal influence of gender on the treatment variable. And so once you've got that, then now to calculate this number, I would have to weight these two, not with the probability of being a man or a woman, but the probability of being a man given that you got that you took the drug, the probability of women given that you took the drug. And that's how you get out of, that's how you can accommodate this reversal of the inequality. So that's the math. But I can give you a much more intuitive picture of what's going on, which is this. So say this is the causal structure. And now suppose that men are more likely to choose to take the drug than women are. And men are also more likely to recover from this illness regardless of whether or not they take the drug. Okay? So now if I ask you, if I tell you, look, I have somebody from this population, and all I'm going to tell you is that they took the drug. That's the information I'm giving you. What do you infer about whether they recovered or not? What do you think? Is it more likely that they recovered or they didn't? Then you can reason as follows. Well, if they took the drug, then they were probably a man. They were more likely to be a man than a woman. And furthermore, if they were a man, they were more likely to recover. So I can infer from the fact that they took the drug that they probably recovered. But I'm making that inference not because the drug is effective for recovery, but because there's this common cause that makes taking the drug more likely and that makes recovering more likely. And so I am just making an inference to recovery from treatment based on the common cause, and I shouldn't conclude that there's a causal influence there. And so the resolution is that in this situation, the drug is actually not effective for recovery. And the only reason I see a positive correlation between taking the drug and recovering is because of this common cause that being a man makes you both more likely to take the drug and more likely to recover. So it's very delicate trying to tease out what are the causal explanations of correlations. But what this shows us is that certain patterns of correlations can be shown to be inconsistent with certain hypotheses about the causal structure. So we know, for example, that we can rule out this causal structure as an explanation of the statistics we've seen, whereas this causal structure is consistent with it. And that helps us make a decision as to whether we should take the drug or not. So in this case, we should clearly not take the drug. So that's how these sorts of algorithms work. And so now I'm going to tell you more about the details before applying them to the kinds of statistical correlations we see in quantum mechanics and trying to figure out what sorts of causal explanations can be provided for quantum correlations. So we need to provide a bit of formalism. So this, physicists love to formalize problems, make them mathematically rigorous. So let's do that for this problem of describing a causal structure. So there's something called a causal model, which consists of two parts. So there's a causal structure, and that's just a graph where the nodes in the graph, these points here, are variables. So these are things like the drug variable, the treatment variable, the recovery variable, the gender variable. So here they're just going to be some abstract variables. And all of the arrows, what the arrows mean is that there's a direct causal influence from one variable to another. So here, for example, there's a direct causal influence from T to X. There's also an indirect causal influence of T on X through Y, for example. So those are represented differently in this sort of approach. And this graph, critically, is not allowed to have any cycles. So something where you would have some sort of arrows that go in a cycle, because that would correspond to something like a grandfather paradox, where you could go back in time and kill your grandfather, such that you weren't born, such that you didn't kill your grandfather. So anytime if you had a causal loop, it would be like time travel and you get problems and contradictions and paradoxes. So you don't allow that. You say there can't be any cycles in this causal structure. Okay, so that's part of a causal model, a hypothesis about what's going on causally. But there's another part to your hypothesis, which is what's the strength of the dependence of one variable on its parents? So you also need to provide some parameters. So for every one of the variables that has no parents in the causal structure, you need to specify what the probability of the different possible values of that variable are. So you specify a whole probability distribution over all the values of that variable. So you know maybe it's highly likely to have its first value and very unlikely to have its second value and so on. So for each of those guys. And then for the variables that do have parents, like Y has W and T as causal parents, you need to specify the probabilities for the different values of Y for every possible choice of values of T and W. So for every set of values that its parents might take, what's going to be the distribution over Y in that case? And if you give me all of that, then it's not hard to show that what you expect to see if you did an experiment where you implemented this causal structure with these parameters many times, and every time you measured the values of all these variables, and you built up statistics. You just how many times did I get one set of values? How many times did I get another set of values? And organized it into some joint probability distribution over these five variables. That distribution is given by this product. You just have to multiply these distributions together to find the overall distribution. So this is the way you go from a hypothesis about the causal structure to a conclusion about what sorts of statistical data you expect to see in an experiment. But what we really want to do here is go the other way. What we want to do in a causal inference algorithm is solve the inverse problem. The input to your problem is some observed statistical distribution over a bunch of variables, and the output that you want is some causal hypothesis. So you want to figure out which sorts of causal hypotheses are consistent with what I've just seen. Right? You know, does X cause Y or does Y cause X? Now that's what we were doing in the Simpson's paradox problem. We're trying to understand which causal structures could explain what we've seen. Okay, so that's the basic outline of this tool I've been telling you about, the causal inference algorithms. That's what they're trying to do. And for the purposes of our discussions of quantum theory, I don't want to tell you anything about the details of these algorithms. Some of them are very sophisticated. I want to just tell you what the fundamental principles that go into them are. Okay, so what are the assumptions upon which they're based? And the first assumption actually has already appeared here implicitly, and that's the assumption that when you see a statistical dependence among variables, you should try to explain it causally. So every statistical dependence needs to be explained causally. That's the idea, that there can't just be sort of, you know, raw correlations that are not due to, you know, one variable causing the other, or maybe some common cause. It's got to be one of those things. Maybe X causes Y, maybe Y causes X, maybe there's a common cause for X and Y, maybe there's both a common cause for X and Y and X causes Y, or maybe there's a common cause and Y causes X. Those are the five possibilities. But it can't just be no causal connection and yet statistical dependent. So that's the first principle. And I said it's already appeared here, and the reasons it's appeared is because I didn't allow, for example, these parentless variables, W, S, and T, to be correlated, right? So when we write down the overall distribution, it's a product of these. So for example, if these are coins, you know, if this is an unbiased coin, so it has probability half of being heads and tail, this has probability half being heads and tail. When I ask what are the probabilities of heads, 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 tails, tails, heads, tails, tails, it's just the product. So it's a quarter, a quarter, a quarter, a quarter. If, you know, the probability distribution where, you know, probability half they're both heads and with probability half they're both tails, you know, that's correlation, that would be not a product. It would be some P of W comma S, right, which could not be factorized in this way. And I haven't allowed that. And the reason I haven't allowed that is because if I think that W and S are correlated, then I should encode that in my causal structure. Right, so I should maybe put in a common cause that acts on W and S, or I should put in a direct cause between S and W. If I think that they're causally connected, then they could be correlated. But if I think that they're not causally connected, then according to that principle, they should not be correlated. Okay, is that clear? Yep. Okay. Good. So let's try out a causal inference problem. Suppose I tell you this. So suppose I tell you there are three variables in my experiment, and I'm going to guarantee to you that they're the only ones that are causally relevant. So there's no other variables like some hidden factor that might act as a cause. I'm going to tell you that they're the only ones that are causally relevant. So there's some causal connections among them. And you've observed some joint distribution over those three variables. And here's the relevant fact that you've observed, which is that if I look at just the variables A and B, I find that they are uncorrelated. They're statistically independent. So when I just look at the joint distribution, probability distribution over A and B, I find that it factorizes. Okay, so I ignore C. If I ignore C, then A and B are uncorrelated. And I find that there's no other things that are uncorrelated. So, you know, A is correlated with C, B is correlated with C. And furthermore, if I learn the value of C, then based on my knowledge of C, I find that A and B become correlated. In any case, that what would you guess might be the causal structure for this sort of statistical dependence? Yes?
Both A and B independently have a direct causal influence on C.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Something like that. Because if you have this, then you expect A and B to be independent. That's, you know, they're parentless variables in this causal structure. So our principle says that they should be independent. But the fact that they both have a causal influence on C means I expect B and C to be dependent, to be correlated, A and C to be dependent, to be correlated. But furthermore, if I condition on C, I also expect to see correlations between A and B. That's a more subtle feature. It's called Bergson's paradox because people find it surprising. But here's an example. If you have a school that admits people based on, you know, academic achievement or musical talent, you know, either one of those is enough. Then so you can think of that as sort of, you know, musical talent, academic achievement, both have a causal influence on whether you get accepted or not. Now, if I condition and I tell you, there's a person in the population, they got accepted, what can you infer about correlations here, right? So is it the case that if I told you something about their musical ability, you could update your information about their academic achievement? The answer is yes. You find a negative correlation. Among the people who are in this school, you have people who are, you know, strong at both. You have people that are only strong at one, but you have nobody who's weak at both. And so you get a negative correlation between those two features. So if you take a person from the school and you say, oh, this person's very musically talented, what do you think is likely? Are they, you know, a high academic achiever or low? It's more likely that they're a low academic achiever because they got accepted to the school. So anyhow, you can, in this kind of causal structure, you can explain the fact that A and B are correlated when you condition on C. That's a kind of nuance that you don't really need to worry about. But certainly the opposite causal structure, where C was a common cause of A and B, wouldn't work. Because if C is a common cause of A and B, then you expect A and B to be correlated. And that would be inconsistent with what you've observed here. And you can go through lots of other possibilities, like if there's a causal arrow between A and B, you would also not expect them to be independent. So this really emerges as a very natural candidate for what's going on. But despite all of that, it turns out that there are other logically possible ways of explaining this. And here's an example. It could be that C is a common cause of A and B, and B is a cause of A. But to make this explanation work, the parameters that I had have to add to the model, so the distribution over C, the distribution of B given C, and the distribution of A given B and C, have to be chosen very carefully. So imagine, for example, that this common cause sets up a positive correlation between A and B, but the direct cause sets up a negative correlation. And it just so happens that they exactly cancel one another and leave you with no correlation. That would be a way of explaining what you saw over here. And so the point is that there are some very special choices of these numbers that will reproduce this guy. But if I change them even a little bit, I don't see the independence anymore. Whereas up here, the beauty of this explanation was that I could put any numbers I like in here for these distributions, and I always see this. This independence is a feature just of the causal structure, not of any particular choice of these distributions. So this kind of explanation is ruled out in these causal inference algorithms on the grounds That's a bad explanation. It only works if you fine-tune the parameters in the explanation. And such explanations are not good explanations. They're logically possible, but we don't tend to think that they're very likely. So, yes?
Sorry. Are causal relationships transitive? Like, so if you know C has a causal influence on B, B has a causal influence on A,
yep.
Then C has a causal influence on A, so you ignore the AC error.
Not quite. Remember, these arrows are direct causal influences. So here you'd say C both has a direct causal influence on A, and also has an indirect causal influence on A via B. Direct causal influences are not transitive, right? So if I told you, for example, suppose this arrow weren't here, and I just told you C influences B directly and B influences A directly, does it follow that C influences A directly? No. So there can be both indirect and direct influences. And that's really what we're using here. We're making use of those two ways that... we make use of the fact that there's two ways in which A and B can become correlated. There's the direct causal influence and there's the common cause. And the fact that there's these two ways that they could become correlated means that I could choose those parameters so that they cancel out and become uncorrelated.
Is it ever important to like enumerate that given however many nodes, how many such relationships can you have?
Well, certainly if you wanted to say, what's the full scope of possibilities for causal hypotheses, then you would want to go and draw all of the graphs that are acyclic, meaning, you know, they don't have any of these cycles that we don't want. Yeah, so they're called directed acyclic graphs, and you can certainly exhaustively list all the ones, and that's really the set of possibilities of what your algorithm could output, right? So I could say, this is the directed acyclic graph corresponding to the causal structure. So yeah, you certainly have that in the background. I haven't drawn out what all of those are, but you could list them all out for three variables, and the problem is to figure out which one works. So here I'm just showing you a couple, and I'm sort of highlighting the fact that even though this isn't the only thing that can explain what you've seen, the alternatives, like this one, provide bad explanations. They're not robust to changes in these parameters. And a nice analogy to this is that if somebody asks you, you know, how many chairs do you see in front of you? And you know, you see one chair and you say, I think it's one chair, and they say, well, you know, there could be a second chair off in the distance behind the first chair such that it's obstructed. So really there could be two chairs. You say, well, yes, there could be, but that chair, you know, of all the places that second chair could be, there's only one place it could be that such that it would be perfectly obstructed by the first chair. So I think I'm pretty confident that there's just one chair there because it would have to be fine-tuned to my, you know, angle of perception to explain it. And so that's sort of what's going on here, that you're saying, yeah, it's possible, but it's unlikely. And so we want to have the best explanation. These are good explanations. These are poor explanations. So that's the second principle that go into these algorithms, that we should not accept causal explanations that have to be fine-tuned. Okay. So now let's start applying these ideas to quantum correlations. So this color doesn't come out very well in this, but here's the idea. So this is the kind of quantum experiment we're going to look at. There's a pair of particles that get generated in some area together. So they're originally interacting. And then they get sent, pulled apart to distant laboratories here and over here. And each particle gets subjected to a measurement. So this is just meant to represent a little measurement device. And these little boxes here are an LED light on the device. And I always just get one or another outcome. So there's only two possible outcomes for this measurement. And I'm going to call that outcome A. So that's a variable that just has two outcomes, and it tells me, you know, what two values, which tell me what the outcome of that measurement was. But there's also multiple choices for what measurement I might do on the first particle. And the variable that ranges over the choices, I'm going to call X. Okay. So you might have seen in quantum mechanics for a particle, you could choose to measure its position, or you could choose to measure its momentum. And quantum mechanics says that you can't choose to measure them both. So actually, you're forced to make a choice, one or the other. You can't measure both simultaneously. But also for example, particles that have a property called spin, you have lots of choices. You can measure the spin along the x-axis, or you can measure the spin along the z-axis. But again, you can't measure them both. So you have a choice you have to make, you know, which measurement I'm going to do. So for the purposes of our discussion, it doesn't matter what properties we're talking about. All I'm going to say is that there's these two different incompatible measurements, and I'm going to label the choice of which one we're doing by X. It's not going to matter what it is. And then the same thing, of course, happens for the second particle. That over on the right-hand side, there's going to be one of two different measurements done and some outcome registered. And so it turns out that quantum mechanics for certain choices of these measurements predicts the following statistical data. So this table ranges over the choices of the settings. So these two settings could be, you know, 0 and 0, or it could be 0 on the left and 1 on the right. 1 on the left, 0 on the right, or 1 on both sides. And it ranges over the possible outcomes. So I could get 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, or 1, 1 as my two outcomes on the left and the right. And here's the probabilities it predicts. So if the two settings are both 0, then it says, well, with almost a probability half, I'm going to get 0, 0, and almost probability half, I'm going to get 1, 1, and with some probability close to 0, I'm going to get one of these other two options, and so on. Okay, so this is, you can trust me on this, you know, quantum mechanics predicts that sometimes you see this sort of data. And then the question is, well, what kind of causal connections between these four variables could potentially explain that statistical data? That's the game. We want to know, how could we explain this causally? And given the way I described the experiment, you'd expect something like this might be possible. So generically, in these algorithms, it could be that there's some extra variables that you haven't directly observed that are causally influencing things. So in my drug trial, you know, if you hadn't observed the gender, you know, you would have just seen this positive correlation. And so you have to take into account the fact that there could be these common causes that you haven't observed. And in this scenario, it seems the most likely thing is that there's some variables here that determine what the properties of these two particles are going to be. So that's a common cause. The properties of the two particles are determined by some mechanism which acts as a common cause for the outcomes that you see on the two sides. And also the local settings, the choice of what measurement you did, could of course influence what that outcome is. That's sort of natural, that what you're measuring determines what the outcome is going to be, but also the properties of the particle determine what the outcome is going to be. And the reason we see correlations in the outcomes is because the properties of these two particles are correlated. That's, you know, if I've prepared the two particles such that when this guy has the first kind of property, this guy also has that property, or, you know, if he has another property, this guy. So if their properties are correlated, I would expect that the outcomes of measurements on those two particles would be correlated. So this is an extremely natural explanation for what's going on, you know, particularly if these things are being done far away from one another, so you don't expect causal influences to go between them. Okay, so that's the setup. So this is the natural causal explanation. And Bell's theorem really talks about whether this kind of causal explanation works or not. So now we get into the topic of Bell's theorem. Okay, so it's exactly what you said. I'm going to do a slight change of graphics. So I'm just going to actually show little red and green lights as the two possible outcomes. And these two kinds of measurements, I'm just going to label as H boxes and T boxes. So they, you know, one could be measuring the Z spin of the particle and the other is measuring the X spin. It really, again, it doesn't matter what properties we're talking about. There's just these two different properties, and I'm going to label the different devices H and T. Okay, and so we're going to imagine an experiment where the choice of what measurement you do on either wing is determined just by a fair coin flip. So that's where H and T come from. So the H box is what you measure if you got the heads, and T what you measure if you got tails. So with probability a quarter, the coins come up both heads, and you're measuring H and H. And with probability a quarter, you measure H and T, T and H, or T and T. And then you just, so you do this many, many times, and you calculate statistics of how many times I got the red or the green outcome on each side. Okay, and I think, yes, okay, so I think now we're ready to do the demonstration of this. So I'm going to need, what I want to do is have two volunteers who are going to play the role of these particles trying to simulate the certain correlations that we see in these experiments. So do I have two willing volunteers? Oh, lots of possible volunteers. OK, how about, oh, sorry, I was just arbitrarily decided to go with you guys. So when there's no volunteers, I try to motivate people by offering cash prizes. And so there is a cash prize to be won. You can each win a loony if you get this right. And for the rest of you, don't worry, there'll be more opportunities to win cash prizes coming up. OK, so I'm also going to need Kelly and one of the chaperones to help me. So could I have two of you come down here? Or both the chaperones? Yeah? OK. No, no, it's fine. Good. It's, no, you just get to hold the cash prizes. So here's your equipment. So it's Andre and
Rachel.
OK, hey, Rachel, could I have you stand way over at that end of the room? Andre, you stay here. OK, so Andre and Rachel are going to play the roles of the measurement devices. I'm going to give them each one of the prize loonies as their coin to flip. Okay, good. And so what's going to happen is that you guys are the two particles. At the beginning of the experiment, you get to correlate your properties, which means you get to make a plan. You're going to be encountering measurement devices that are either going to be measuring this H property or this T property, and your job is going to be to tell the measurement device to give the outcome green or the outcome red. So that's what you're going to do. But you should have a plan. So your plan should be something like, look, if you get the heads question, answer green. And if I get the tails question, I'm going to answer red. You know, something like that. You can cooperate in terms of what you will do. But when the experiment gets started, you're not allowed to shout across the room, I got heads, what did you get? That's not allowed. And you won't win the prize money if you do that. And just so that we make sure that there is no communication of information across the room, after Andre and Rachel flip their coins, they're going to write down on the card that I've given them what outcome they got, H or T, so that you know you can't hear across the room. If they were to say it to you, then you might hear it across the room. So you're going to write it on the card, you can look at the card, see what the outcome was, and then you just write down your answer, R or G for red or green, again, so that across the room nobody hears it, so that there can't be any communication of information about what outcome is happening. So that's how it's going to go down. And now I'm going to tell you what correlations you need to generate to win the money. So you might want to stand up and look at the screen. OK, so I've already said the stuff at the top. So the idea is this, that if it happens that you guys are subjected to the same measurement, then your outcomes should agree. So if after the whole experiment's over and I collect the cards, they're both H or they're both T, then if your outcomes agree, so you've both answered red or both answered green, you win. But if you've answered with different colors, you lose. And then if, however, the measurements, if the coins came up such that the measurements on the two sides are different, so it's heads on one side, tails on the other side, then your outcomes should also disagree. So you should be reporting different colors. That's what you need to do to win. So that's it. That's the rules of the game. So question, is it clear what you need to do?
Yes.
OK. Is it clear to everybody else how this game is going to work? In that case, what we're going to do is we're going to take a few minutes. You guys can leisurely discuss what you want your plan to be. And when you're ready, let me know. And while they're doing that, I want the rest of you to maybe get together with the people beside you and figure out how you would win this game if you were the particles. And then.
We can describe whiteboards, small whiteboards, so they can write about it.
I think it's okay if they just discuss. They seem to have like notepads and.
I remember this lecture 2 years ago. I studied 2 years ago.
Uh-huh,
and I remember this lecture.
Right, right. Same one, basically.
I did the rest of it last year. But
I was traveling.
Yeah.
So what you guys are doing is clear, yes?
Recording.
Write it down.
Do we tell them about like?
Don't tell them out loud. Just write it down.
Yeah.
And then they'll report it. Yeah.
We show them.
You show them. They write it down. You take the card back. Hold on to those two loonies. You're ready? Okay, our particles are ready. So let's have the measurement devices distribute. Okay, so what I want you guys to do is split up, go to the measurement devices, and then we will simultaneously have the flipping of the coins. Doesn't have to be exactly simultaneous. There you go. And now write down what your outcomes were. And then the particles will give their answers.
There's a bit.
Oh, yeah. Done here? Good. All right, done here as well? Okay, the suspense is killing me. So, let's have a drum roll. So, on the left, it was heads. And on the right, it was heads. And on the left, the answer was red. And on the right, the answer was red. So you win. You may collect your prizes and take your seat. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I have just one question, which is, what was your strategy?
Well, we set it so that
thank you.
If they read heads, then we would tell them red.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we would tell them green if they read tails.
Okay. Yeah. It's a good strategy.
If we're supposed to have different outcomes for the same thing, we would just have one person have H red, T green, and then the other person have H green, T red.
Good. Hold that thought. That will come in handy soon. So. Let me just display what the challenge was, which is that, you know, if it happened that they were both T or both H, then the outcome should agree. If they were different, the outcome should disagree. And so if you, for example, choose to report, both people report green for heads and reds for tails, then you're going to have disagreement across the diagonals, agreement across the horizontals, and everything's going to work out well. Okay, so well done. Here's the new challenge. Suppose that when the same measurement happens, the outcomes have to disagree, but when different measurements happen, the outcomes have to agree. So I want you guys to all spend a minute thinking about this case, and then I'll be asking for solutions. Maybe hang on, because I want to get to the end of this, but then I can certainly take your question. I just don't want to let this go on for too long, so I get. So are we ready? Do people have an idea? All right, so because the two of you have already won prize money, you're not eligible for this challenge any longer. But does somebody else want to volunteer to give the answer if you get it right? So back there, in black, yes. Yeah, come up if you want to write it on the board.
So I like
Just, yeah, tell me what the what sort of solution could generate,
like,
could win this game.
One of the people, like, for example, says that it's red when the letter is H, and the other one says red when the letter is P.
And yeah, and that does it. So here's your prize. Very easy. So you're the situation now is just that on the diagonals you're supposed to agree, and on the horizontals you're supposed to disagree. So obviously, if you just make, you know, red, green, and green, red, you do it. So you get an idea for how easy it is for these particles to generate correlations that have certain interesting features. Now here's the more interesting challenge, and this one's going to be worth a toonie. Okay, so whenever the measurement is the same on both sides, whenever the measurement T is made on both sides, then the outcomes have to disagree. So if it's T and T, the outcomes should disagree. But in all other cases, so if it's H and H, or H and T, or T and H, then the outcomes have to agree. So I want you to take a few minutes and see if you can figure this one out.
Are you talking about Monty Hall paradox, which is different from Monty Hall?
Yeah.
Very
different
from Monty
Hall. But
here you have to say, there's a case where on one side green, and you have to know this one might be red or green based on what the other side has, which you don't know because they can't tell you. Therefore, you might not have time.
So does anybody have a suggestion? Yes?
If you take, like, we were just thinking, like, if we just take, like, if you were, like, we'll both take red no matter what you split, you would win 75% of the time.
Right. So not 100% of the time.
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody think they can do it 100% of the time? Does anybody, maybe you want to say, give me a proof that it can't be done 100% of the time? Is there? Does anybody have an argument for why it might not be possible to do it? You've already won money, so I can't take you. Go ahead.
So I'll just throw it
up. Sure.
Two T's and then an H, and this one has to disagree.
Mm-hmm.
And then this one has to agree, this one has to agree, this one has to agree.
Yep.
Then if you had like a green here, this one would have to be red, this one would have to be red to agree with that, this one would have to
Excellent. Thank you. Wait, you have to collect your prize money. There you go. That's exactly right. And in fact, I don't even have to go through this slide because it's the same argument, except with slightly different colors. And then you don't have this agreement. So it doesn't matter where you start. As you go around the loop, you're always going to get a contradiction somewhere. If you ask, how frequently could you possibly win the game, your strategy is the optimal one. You know, if I just, no matter what colors I lay down, at most I'm going to generate these correlations right 3 out of 4 times. Right? So remember, you know, these 4 possibilities for the choices of settings are all equally likely. So as you said, 3/4 of the time with, say, the strategy where you have all red or all green, you can win the game. So if we were doing this up front and you know we played this game, suppose we did it many, many times, then you'd expect that the contestants could only win 3/4 of the time. You know, they would set up their strategy. There's no way to win 100% of the time. So they should only win 75% of the time. So here's the interesting thing. If we do this with quantum particles, then they find they can win the game 85% of the time. So how do they do it? That's the question. How do the quantum particles manage to win this game more than 75% of the time? So the first question I want to ask you is, forget about the quantum particles for a moment. Suppose we were doing it here. Can you imagine ways that the contestants could cheat and win this game more than 75% of the time? Yes? Right. If they could send some signal across that would tell the other person what the outcome of the coin toss was on the other side, they could succeed because, you know, for instance, let's say over here on the left, this person's trying to they got T and they want to know whether to report red or green. If they could learn that whether the other person got heads or tails, they could report green if the other person got heads and red if the other person got tails, and then they would have agreement and disagreement. So if their outcome could depend not just on their local setting but on the distance setting, then they could win 100% of the time. Other ways you could imagine the game being rigged. Maybe if the chaperones were in on it. Yeah. But what would they do? How would you rig it?
Make sure that always either heads or tails.
Right. So they wouldn't really flip their coins. There would be some correlation. They would, ensure that only heads came up when the particles were prepared to answer a certain kind of question. Exactly. So those are two kinds of cheating strategies. So if the choices are not random but correlated with the local strategies, that's one way to go. If you have communication of the choice of measurement to the other wing of the experiment, that's another way to go. But now here's an interesting thing. If you want to, so consider this second one where you're worried about the communication. Suppose you do the experiment carefully in the following sense. So you know something about relativity theory. What if you made these two measurements actually extremely far apart? And very fast, so that the choice of measurement is made at one point and an outcome is registered shortly thereafter. And over here, same thing happens. But these are so far apart that actually, even if the message about which measurement was chosen travels at the speed of light, it doesn't get to the other wing in time to inform it about what outcome to deliver. So this guy has to generate an outcome before it could ever learn about what measurement was chosen over here. So suppose you do it with the quantum particles in this setup. So then the communication strategy is out. What would you expect happens? Maybe 75% of the time? Turns out the quantum particles still do it 85% of the time. So even though you manage to separate these things and ensure that if the causal influence was propagating at the maximum speed, it still couldn't get there on time, you still see this 85% probability. Okay, so let's go back to the question that we started with, which is, you know, what sort of causal explanation could be given for the correlations we see in quantum theory? So here is a correlation table that corresponds to that third challenge I gave you guys. So it's a slightly different way of representing it. But if so here is 0 and 1 is like the heads and tails choice. So for the first three cases, the outcomes A and B are either both 0 or both 1, which is perfect correlation, right? So it's just probability half they're both 0, probability half they're both 1. Similarly with these guys. And in the last case, which was the tails-tails case before, they're perfectly anti-correlated. So with probability half, it's 0 and 1, and with probability half, it's 1 and 0. Okay, so this is just the statistical data corresponding to that third challenge. And we know, what we showed was that you can't win that challenge with a local strategy. So this idea of a common cause that explains the correlations we see is ruled out. Okay, and then what we also said was that, as long as this pattern happens with greater than 75% probability, it's still ruled out. So the quantum correlations I showed you earlier had almost probability a half for a 0, 0, and 1, 1. And if I sum these two numbers together, that's the 85%. So with 85% probability in these three cases, I get correlation. And with 85% probability in this last case, I get anti-correlation. So this is the quantum statistics. And we also said that we can't explain that with this model because it's more than 75%. So we have to rule out this model for the quantum statistics. So the very natural seeming model for what's going on is ruled out. That's the main result of Bell's theorem. Now I want to fold in this recent work about causal discovery and what it says about what causal explanation we should provide for these statistics. So once you've ruled this one out, you might say, okay, well, let's go with our cheating strategy. Let's imagine that what's going on in nature is that there's a causal influence from the setting on the left all the way over to the outcome on the right. So that's like communicating whether it was heads or tails across the room. So that could certainly explain what we've seen. Of course, it's a bit uncomfortable because relativity theory says we don't expect any causal influences to move faster than the speed of light. So you could say if you think relativity theory prohibits superluminal causes, that this sort of thing ought to be ruled out. But here's the thing, even if you allow that there's some room, that there could be these superluminal causes, and some people say relativity really only prohibits superluminal signals, like sending messages faster than the speed of light, but it's okay with superluminal causes, then you still have a problem because these statistics certainly exhibit the fact that there's no signal sent from the left to the right. So let's go through that. Why is it that in this experiment, somebody over here cannot send signals to somebody over there? So how would they? They might say, well, I'm going to toggle the value of x, and if it turned out that the kinds of probabilities of outcomes you saw over here depended on what the value of x was. You got certain sorts of statistics of red and green over here for one value of x and different sorts of statistics for another. Then you could use that to signal. I could just encode my zeros and ones in what setting I choose over here. And if I just, for example, if I want to encode a zero, then we do 100 rounds of this where I set x to zero, and then you look at the statistics of those 100 rounds. And then when I want to do a 1, we do 100 rounds where this is 1, and you look at the statistics, and you can tell them apart, and so you get the information. But if you look here, you find that that's not possible, because let's say we ask, what's the relative probability of getting b equal to 0 and b equal to 1 for, say, y equal to 0? So now we're in one of these two rows where y is 0. That's the setting over there. But x could be 0 or 1. And now we're asking, well, what's the relative probability that b is 0 or b is 1? So the b is equal to 0 cases are these two columns, and the b is equal to 1 cases are these two columns. So if I sum these two numbers up, I get 0.5. If I sum these two numbers up, I get 0.5. So over here it says, for x is equal to 0 and y is equal to 0, it's equally likely that b will be 0 or 1. And over here, if I sum up these two guys and I sum up these two guys, I also get 0.5, 0.5. So I also say, when y is 0 over there, if I change x to 1, it's still the case that these two outcomes are equally likely. So as I toggle this guy, it doesn't change the relative likelihood of those distant outcomes, so I can't use it to signal. So in that sense, it's consistent with relativity theory, that it doesn't allow you to send signals faster than the speed of light. But this sort of explanation still seems a bit odd in the sense that it has these superluminal causes. And if there are these causes going faster than the light, then why can't I use them to send signals? Like, the causes are there. Shouldn't I be able to use them somehow to send signals? Well, remember what we said in the early part of the lecture. Causal explanations are bad if they're fine-tuned. This causal explanation, though logically possible, has to be fine-tuned. Why? Because generically, if I just threw in arbitrary parameters, conditional probabilities of B given its parents, because of this causal arrow, I would generically expect B and X to be correlated in this sort of causal graph. The only way to make sure that B and X are not correlated, you know, what we just saw, the fact that there's no signals, you know, B is going to be equally likely to be 0 or 1, regardless of what X is. That's a lack of correlation. The only way to make these guys uncorrelated in this causal model is to choose those parameters extremely carefully. And so the only way to sort of resolve this tension between no superluminal signaling and the existence of a superluminal cause is to fine-tune the model. So all these causal discovery algorithms, which are successful in classical contexts, basically say this is a bad explanation, you know, regardless of you know, what you think about the status of superluminal causes in relativity. It's just this tension requires fine-tuning, and we're unwilling to grant that. Okay, so then we go looking for other causal explanations. Here's another one where, you know, maybe the we have a kind of conspiracy where the choice of setting on the left is not at random, but maybe there's some common cause that determines that and also determines, for instance, the outcome on the right. I could have made it a common cause with something else, like the setting on the right or this variable here. But let's just take the case where there's a common cause of the setting on the left and the outcome on the right. So again, most people react to this by saying, but you know, that setting could be determined by a coin flip. It doesn't feel like it's fixed by the past. I could you know, take, you know, the latest Twitter feed and hash it up to get a random number and say, well, how could that really be correlated with something that's happening very far away in space? It's kind of implausible. And furthermore, people say, instead of flipping a coin, I could just use my own free will to decide whether it's going to be heads or tails. And to say that there's a common cause means I'm not free to choose what I want to say. So these are all responses that people have given against this kind of explanation. But again, regardless of what you think of all of those ideas and the status of free will, this, by the lights of these causal discovery algorithms, is a bad causal explanation. Because whenever you have a common cause acting on two variables, generically you expect that they're going to be correlated. And the only way to make sure that they're not correlated is to fine-tune the parameters in your model to cancel out those correlations and recover the fact that there are no signals that can be sent from X to B. So again, this sort of causal explanation is ruled out on the grounds that it's fine-tuned. And here's another even crazier attempt to explain it, which is you might say, what if causes can propagate backward in time and influence things in the past? So maybe, you know, the outcome of the coin flip over here on the left is not reaching across space to influence things on the right. Maybe it's reaching backward in time to influence what the strategy was that was decided upon before going out. You know, that would be able to generate these kinds of correlations. And, you know, many people say, but that's too crazy for me. I don't like, you know, causes that propagate backwards in time. And again, the point is that even if you're willing to deal with that, if you look at this graph, it has an indirect causal influence from X to B. And so generically, if you put down generic parameters in here, you're going to see correlations between X and B. The only way to explain the fact that you don't see correlations is to fine-tune the parameters. And so again, it's considered a bad explanation by the light of these causal discovery algorithms. So you can then ask, well, out of all, we talked a bit about all the causal networks that could possibly exist here, and I allow that you can now add extra variables, which are, you know, hidden, not the ones you've observed, but this, like, this lambda variable that was a hidden common cause. You can ask, out of all the possibilities, can any of them explain the correlations we've seen without fine-tuning? And you can prove a theorem that says, no, none of them work. So it looks like we can't have a satisfactory causal explanation of the Bell correlations. And that's how I like to think about the mystery of Bell's theorem. It's a challenge to the possibility of providing a causal explanation of those correlations. And remember the principles. The one principle was statistical correlations should be explained causally. To me, that's a very sound principle. To give up on that in quantum theory, it's very central to the scientific enterprise, I would say, that when you see statistical correlations, you should try to explain them causally. I think definitely in real life, we would be suspicious of anyone who, you know, didn't subscribe to that principle. You know, the example I like to give is, if I go to my doctor and I say, you know, I read a study that said there's this positive correlation between this activity I do and developing cancer, you know, do you think that's a causal relation? And the doctor said, oh, I don't think statistical correlations need to be explained causally. You know, I would just say, well, you know, can I please have a new doctor? Because that's, you know, that we, you know, either there's a common cause or there's a direct cause, you know, that something explains these statistical correlations. So I think it's very odd to say that, in, you know, in this, out of all of science, in this one arena, quantum physics, we should just give up on the idea that correlations need to be explained causally. I think that's a bad move. And the other principle was this idea that we shouldn't fine-tune our explanations. So maybe there's a bit more wiggle room there. But again, this is a principle that I think is used generically across science, that when your explanations only work for very specific choices of your parameters and no others, that tends to be a sign that you haven't really understood what's going on. And so I also think that these that no fine-tuning principle is a good principle. So the principles that go into deriving this contradiction are pretty sound. They seem pretty good. And so it's a real challenge to try to make sense of how to provide causal explanations of quantum correlations. And different people have different ideas. There's a lot of controversy about what conclusion to draw from Bell's theorem. And I would say that there's, you know, opportunity for all of you to solve this problem. Like, this is a long-standing problem in physics. I don't think anyone has delivered a really decisive resolution. Certainly not in the sense of no one's delivered a resolution that everybody else decides, yes, that's clearly the right one. There's still no consensus about this. Yes?
You said that there's a theorem that shows that derives that contradiction.
Yeah.
What would that be called?
So this is in a paper of mine with a former master's student. So his name was Wood. So if you look for his name and my name, you'll find that theorem. The Bell's theorem itself is the one that sort of rules out that common cause explanation. So the stuff we added was this business about the no fine-tuning principle and how that is a good principle for inferring causal explanations. Okay, so that's the idea, that we have these principles. They're in contradiction with these correlations. When we go to the lab and we do experiments, we find that, you know, although we don't get the ideal correlations, we can nonetheless get correlations that win this game with greater than 75% probability. So we know that, you know, something has to give. So maybe one of these assumptions, but maybe also some implicit assumptions that we've made that we just haven't listed here. There's always other assumptions that we're making besides these ones. So for example, when I showed you what a causal model was, there was an assumption that the nodes were variables that took on one of a set of values. And my information about those variables was represented by probabilities, you know, real numbers that are positive. And there's a certain rules about how you multiply probabilities together to infer things. So all of that is part of the assumptions. And, you know, it could be that it's some of that which has to go and to make sense of the Bell correlations. Okay, so with, yes, go ahead.
So I'm not too well versed in Bell's theorem. So were those original probabilities, were they derived from calculation or from experiment?
So it was a theoretical result. So Bell originally started thinking about this question of whether, the story went something like this. Einstein said that he thought that we should understand quantum descriptions to be incomplete, that there should be these hidden variables which specify what the outcomes of measurements should be deterministically rather than the probabilistic way that quantum theory does. And he pointed out that there were not the Bell experiment, but similar experiments where the only way you could secure a local explanation of what was going on was by positing the existence of these extra variables. So he showed that, you know, already in the late 20s and in the early 30s. He said, look, guys, unless you endorse these hidden variables of mine, you're not going to get a local explanation. So if you're wedded to locality, no causes at a distance, you'd better go for these hidden variables and admit that the quantum description is not complete. So there's a lot of philosophical arguments. People didn't really buy Einstein's line, but I think he was right about that argument. And then the surprise came when Bell showed, actually, even if you endorse these hidden variables and say that the quantum description is incomplete, you still can't salvage locality. So, you know, Bell came up with this kind of experiment we just saw, which Einstein had not conceived of. And so actually, the way that Einstein had hoped to salvage locality, Bell showed was not possible, didn't work, that there were experiments where you couldn't salvage locality in that way. I find that sometimes the popular science mischaracterizes Einstein a little bit. So you often hear Einstein quoted as, you know, quantum theory involves spooky action at a distance. And he did say something like that, but he wasn't saying that as, I think quantum theory is like this. He was more saying, you know, my opponents in this debate claim that you should think of the quantum description as complete. But if you do that, it involves this spooky action at a distance. And so I think that their views of quantum theory are wrong. And I would like a view which has no spooky action at a distance, which means that the quantum description is not complete. So Einstein was basically making an argument that assumed no spooky actions and concluded that the quantum description was not complete. Okay, so then Bell comes along and he's thinking about Einstein's argument and he comes up with this new experiment and he shows that it predicts correlations. It's not quite what I showed you, his first example was not the example I showed you, but he showed that quantum theory predicts correlations that would violate locality. And then there were improvements and there were experiments done which showed that, in fact, the experiments were in accord with quantum theory and not in accord with a local theory. Other questions? Okay, well, we've only got a few minutes left, so I thought I would just say a couple of extra things about Bell's theorem. So it turns out that this quantum weirdness, you might call it, or these quantum mysteries, in recent years have been shown to be implicated in certain kinds of advantages for information processing that you have in a quantum world versus if you lived in a classical world. So actually, we're better off living in a quantum world in some sense because there's things we can do that we would not be able to do if we lived in a classical world. So the subject of information theory, and I guess you're going to be visiting IQC, so you'll probably hear more about information theory. So there's various, you know, different types of information processing problems. So computation's an obvious problem. So you might, for example, want to find the prime factors of some very large number. That's a nice example of a computation. Or you might want to search a database for a particular entry. And so classically, a computer is just based on classical physics. So that's the sort of principles of an abacus. And it puts bounds on how quickly and how well you can solve various computational problems. Another information processing problem is a communication problem. So you might, for example, want to compress the data that you send down a channel so that you can get as much information in your message as possible. You might have a lot of noise on your channel, so you want to use schemes to correct that noise and overcome it. So these are all part of the subject of communication theory. And then there's also cryptography, where you might say you're worried that there's an eavesdropper tapping into on your channel. So the eavesdropper is always called Eve. You'll learn that soon enough. And so you want to encode your information in a way such that the eavesdropper doesn't get any insight into what you're actually communicating. So there's ways of doing that as well. And so all that quantum information theory is, it has all the same objectives. So you're still looking to do classical computations and communicate classical bits and send messages. But the components that you get to use are now upgraded to quantum components. So now you can build a computer that operates on the laws of quantum physics. So replace your abacus with a set of ions and a trap that are operating under the principles of quantum theory. And similarly, you know, you could replace your classical telephone lines with, you know, fiber optic cables that are sending quantum states of light and use that for both communication and trying to get security against eavesdroppers. And we know that for, you know, all these sorts of tasks, there are in fact quantum advantages. You can do things quantumly that you couldn't classically. So I'm going to give you just one example of that, and it's a toy example, but it's so one of the biggest deals is an advantage for computation. So people have shown that if we can build a quantum computer, then it's there's some uncertainty about certain problems actually being hard classically. But most computer scientists think that there really is a gap between easy problems and hard problems classically. And so under that assumption, what's been shown is that quantum computers can solve things that we classically thought were hard problems. And so quantum computers seem to offer an advantage. And I'm going to tell you just a little bit about how these funny correlations could potentially lead to computational advantage. So this is the toy system, the sort of microcosm in which I'm going to explain it. I'm going to imagine that the computer looks something like this. So you have the classical inputs to your problem, and this is the classical output to your problem. This is the computation. And what you're going to have is a classical computer and a kind of quantum part. And the quantum part's going to come in the form of some particles that exhibit interesting quantum correlations. And so for every particle, I can control it. So I could, for example, use some bits in my classical computer to decide what measurement to do and then register the outcome. So you can think of a flow of information going back and forth to the particle, what I measure on it, what outcome it receives. And so I can collect all those outcomes and do some computations on them and generate my output. So that's one model for quantum computation. It's called the measurement-based model for quantum computation, where you do measurements on quantum systems that have been prepared in interesting entangled states. The thing on top is just a classical computer. The thing on the bottom is a quantum computer. But now what I'm going to do is I'm going to make this a very weak classical computer. So I'm not actually going to give you an example of quantum mechanics taking you from what you can do classically to something better. That does exist. But I'm going to show you how I can take a classical computer that can do almost nothing and take it to something that can do things that are more interesting. So I want to imagine that the classical computer you start with is one that can only do XOR gates and NOT gates. So so if I have, what am I calling my inputs, X and Y? Let me give them different names just in case I got it wrong. Let's say the inputs are S and T. The possible values for a pair of bits in a computer are these four values. And so if I take the XOR, which is also called the parity, it just is the sum mod 2. So the sum of 0 and 0 is 0. The sum of 0 and 1 is 1. 1 and 0 is 1. But the sum of 1 and 1 is 0. So it would be 2, but we're working in modular arithmetic, so it's 0. So this is the functioning of what's called an XOR gate. You know, if you think of the zeros as false and the ones as true, then this is just asking whether S or T, but not both, are true. And so it registers that in these cases, S or T is true. These cases, they're both false or both true. So you allow your computer to do these kinds of operations, take two bits, calculate their XOR, and you allow it to do things like just flip things, turn 0 into 1, which is usually just called the NOT gate. And that's it. So it's allowed to take the NOTs of bits and do XORs. And if you look at these formulas, S and T always appear linearly. But if I think of an AND gate, S and T, that's a product. So if these are false and true, the only case where I expect S and T to be true is if they're both true. And the way, in Boolean algebra, I represent that as just the product of these numbers. So 1 times 1 is 1, and all the other cases, the product is 0. So the AND gate involves a multiplication of the variables. These guys don't. So this is a nonlinear term because it involves a product. These guys are all linear in S and T. So what we do is we say, let's allow this classical computer to only have these linear gates, the XOR gate, the NOT gate, and then it can do almost nothing. It's a very lame computer. And the question is, can we use the quantum stuff to upgrade it and maybe allow it to do some AND gates? Because then it can do some interesting computations, like the way your laptop can do. So here's how we do it. We take these funny correlations we talked about, right? So I take a pair of these particles prepared in one of these special entangled states, and I take the two inputs, the S and the T, that I want to do an AND gate on, and I feed them in, and they choose what measurement to do on each of these particles. So that was like our head and tails variables. And then I get some outcomes, which I'm calling A and B. I feed those outcomes into my XOR gate, and I report the output of that as the output of the whole computation. So what happens? Well, remember, I'm not going to talk about the quantum correlations per se, but that third example we looked at earlier, where you got perfect correlation between the two outcomes for the first three cases and perfect anti-correlation for the last case. Those correlations can be written as follows. If I take the XOR of A and B, it's just the product of X and Y, right? Because in the last case, the product of X and Y is 1, and there I can only get A0, B1, or A1, B0, so A plus B is 1 in those cases. And in the other three cases, X times Y is 0, and there A and B are either both 0 or both 1, and that corresponds to A plus B being 0. So in all, this data table can be represented by this equation, that the parity or XOR of A and B is X times Y. So if that's the way that A and B are related to X and Y, if I feed in the two inputs to my computation as X and Y, and then I take A and B and I do this XOR on it, the output is just going to be X times Y, which is just the product of my two inputs. So I have succeeded in calculating this AND gate. And the way I did it is using this mysterious correlation, which we saw earlier, seems to resist being explained causally. So I've made use of that strange feature of quantum mechanics as a tool for souping up the computational power of a classical computer. And so that's meant to be a toy example of how it could be that quantum computers somehow have more computational power than a classical computer does. Okay, so that's pretty much all I wanted to say. Let me just end by saying that personally, I think that this challenge to providing causal explanations of quantum correlations is really important. Because as you have probably heard, one of the big outstanding problems in physics is to make sense of quantum theory together with relativity theory. We still don't know how to merge those together. And relativity theory, like if you think of special relativity, it has these light cone structures. A big part of special relativity is talking about what can cause what. And general relativity also is you can think of as being about what can cause what, and you know the presence of masses changes what the causal structure is, who can causally influence what. So general relativity is all about causal structure. And in quantum mechanics, we don't know how to provide causal explanations of correlations. And so I feel that until we have sorted that out, we probably won't be able to unify it with a theory of dynamical causal structure. That's general relativity. And so I think it's worthwhile thinking deeply about this problem some more and trying to provide a causal explanation of quantum correlations. So that's it.